If your WordPress site matters, your host matters. You can have rock-solid, fast, and secure WordPress hosting for a fraction of what you pay for your cable bill. WP Engine can increase your conversions and protect your WordPress site from hackers. Learn more at wpengine.com/lyw. This is Love Your Work. This show will help you find the clues that will lead you to your calling. I'm David Cadavy, and on Love Your Work, you know I bring in entrepreneurs and creators that have broken away from the pack. And this week's episode is a bit of an experiment. I've had Nirial, author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, on the show before. He and I had a little debate about digital distraction back in episode 21. And Nir and I have been exploring new book ideas independently, and we've been practicing writing about those ideas somewhere within that space of digital distraction. And I've been leaning more into the productivity space, which you've heard a lot of on this podcast. So we recently had a call where Nir and I discussed where we were headed, how we're testing out new ideas, and how we might position new ideas. And we figured, just in case, we'd record the conversation in case it happened to sound like a good podcast episode. And I think it will make a good episode, especially if you're an aspiring author who wonders how to home in on the right book idea. We'll talk about writing for Medium.com and why it's such a powerful tool for testing out new ideas. I'll get very, very specific about my process for analyzing ideas I write on Medium and how I decide what's worth pursuing further. And we'll also talk about the psychology of book positioning, book marketing, and coming up with titles for books. So it'll be a bit of an extension of the book marketing conversation that I had with Tucker Max on episode 29. Now, note that I say we, and I'm aware that I ended up dominating the conversation, and this is just something that I happen to do sometimes when I get too excited about something. Still, it should be useful, and if you have no book writing aspirations at all, it will perhaps be an unsettling behind-the-scenes look at how the sausage is made in book publishing. Here's the episode. When you're billing your clients, the last thing you want to waste your time and mental energy on is creating invoices. FreshBooks customers get paid an average of 5 days faster. Get your free 30-day trial at cadavy.net/freshbooks. Record on this, and you know that my microphone sounds like a robot sometimes.
So oh, okay.
In about 40 minutes,
talk through it, or should I tell you?
Yeah, you should definitely let me know, because it'll totally be ruined. This microphone is a cheap microphone, and I don't know. I feel like the sound is pretty good, but it goes a little haywire.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah. So you've seen some of my writing.
I have. You're everywhere. It's fantastic. I love it. It's good stuff.
So I'm interested in the perception then of somebody who is from on the outside. Then where is everywhere? Where have you? What have you been seeing?
Let me tell you how great you are. please start already.
Tell me about all the things that you like about what you've. You know.
Yeah, about me. Tell me.
Yeah, please.
No,
hair the way it is? Do you think that I'm good looking, or you know?
yeah, all that stuff and more. I've seen you on Medium, and your articles are getting shared and liked, and it's great. I'm just so happy to see it.
Yeah, it's you know, actually the conversation that we had that wasn't a podcast conversation, and I don't plan to make this a podcast conversation either, but you know, it could be. The conversation we had was really helpful because I had worked all those months on that book proposal, and then I hadn't published anything for like 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
And I started publishing stuff, and then I realized that nobody gave a shit about what I was saying.
Well, I'm so glad that I could take a little bit of credit for pushing you. I remember you when we talked, like, context of the conversation was like, oh, I want to do a big old book.
Yeah.
And I was like, don't do a big old book. Do lots of little blog posts. Mm. And I'm really glad to see that you took at least a little bit of that advice to heart. Of course, you did
totally.
All the heavy lifting of actually writing the articles, which is the hard part.
Well, it's been really awesome because, like, there were so many different ideas. Like, my entire approach to the things that I wanted to say and the things I wanted to say, I guess I was a little bit in the dark as to like how to get people to pay attention to things these days, because last time that I had anything that was really popular was Hacker News days, and that was a totally different world. And then Medium has been just a great testing bed, because you can put stuff out there and you can get highlights and recommends, and you can see like what specifically are people reacting to, what specifically is resonating with people.
Right. It's really cool. I mean, are you doing anything special in terms of getting it noticed or giving it any kind of bump of attention? Is that something you're doing, or do you just write and post?
No, I pretty much write and post, and I share on Facebook, and I share on Twitter. And actually, I have a bit of a process to it, which I'll write a post. I try to keep them around 500 words. Mm-hmm. Which has been great at making myself shorter winded and making things more punchy and easier to react to. And then at like a certain point, I look at the recommendation ratio, and I want to see at least 10% recommendation ratio, that like the number of views that if it has 1,000 views, which actually is quite a bit, then they better have 100 recommends. If it has 100 views, it better have at least 10 recommends. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I noticed there's a little bit of a velocity to that. And then at that point, I've become an author in so many different publications on Medium, like The Mission, which I think is the most read one that isn't a Medium publication, and various others, just being invited over time after writing. I just accepted pretty much every invitation I got. And so now that I'm a contributor to any of those publications, like The Mission, I can write something and I wait and make sure that it's people reacting to it decently, and then I put it in The Mission.
And then, so wait, do you if it doesn't get the ratio you want of 10%, then would you do something differently? Do you change anything?
Yeah, then I just go, what I do is I go into my room and I shut the door and I turn off the lights, and then I get into bed and I cry all day. No, I'm just kidding.
And that magically makes it popular.
That magically makes it popular. No, I don't know. I guess it's weird, because I hate writing. I've made a habit out of it. Like for 2 months, I made a habit of writing and publishing a 500 word article first thing in the morning every day, every weekday. Mm. I did that for 2 months, and there wasn't much reaction to that. But now I've got it to where I do it pretty much Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I totally dread it. You know, I'm like in bed that morning, and like, oh, I don't want to get out and do it. And then I go up to my computer and I start writing, and I'm like, I don't even know what the hell I'm writing. And then eventually, sometimes it'll start to make sense. And sometimes I'm just like cringing. I'm like, I can't believe I'm publishing this piece of garbage.
But you do it anyway.
And I do it anyway. And sometimes the reaction is better than I expect.
That's awesome. And so if it's crap and people aren't reading it, you don't go back and try and make it better.
There have been times where, you know, I'm sitting down and doing this all in one sitting. So sometimes I go to the gym afterwards or something, and maybe I'll think of a better title or a better angle for the title, and I might change the title. I might do that stuff sometimes. But then, you know, there's always tomorrow. I can write about the same concept in a different way.
Yeah,
or with a different title.
And then you put it. Oh, that's interesting. So you'll sometimes just do a whole new draft on the same theme.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of overlap going on. It was easier earlier on because I had a lot of backed up thinking that I had done when I spent those few months just writing to myself in the proposal writing process. And so there was a lot of different ideas that could be chopped up and spit out as 500 word things at that point in time. And so sometimes I write something and I notice like, oh, a lot of people highlighted that sentence.
That's cool.
Well, I can write an article about that.
about that sentence. That's awesome. That's really good.
Which doesn't necessarily always go in the same direction. Like, I think sometimes there's certain observations or something that like don't make a good article, but that do make a good observation in the middle of a
sentence. Yeah. Right. But once in a while, if a bunch of people highlight something and say, "Oh, that's interesting," that it could make for another article. That's a great tip.
Well, yeah, I think that. This for me is how my creative process always goes, right? Like, I have to do the. It's one thing I like about doing the podcast is like I get to have the conversations, I get to do everything ad hoc, and then watch the patterns emerge, mm-hmm. and that's where you start to find the things that you can dig deeper on, and which, you know, I guess is kind of the way your book got so popular, right? You were writing about this stuff. Were you trying to? You know, why were you writing about this stuff?
Yeah, it was just interesting to me. I had questions on my mind that I wanted to address, and I just kept writing about it. But I think what's cool about Medium, I think when I first started writing, Medium didn't exist. And it sounds like when you first started writing and you know, we were kind of keeping our fingers crossed for the Hacker News gods to pick us up and get it popular. But if it wasn't for that, nobody read our stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it's a real testament to the platform of Medium in that if stuff is reasonably interesting, it is kind of a meritocracy in that it gets seen, it gets spread, it gets read eventually, and that's really interesting. I mean, I think Ev would be really happy to hear that.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's really amazing, and I get a sense that there was a big wave going on around April or May, and that maybe people aren't spending as much time reading it now that could just be that my posts aren't as popular. I don't know. Or I've gotten complacent where like I'm looking at posts and like, cause I read a lot of those posts on the podcast and so to do so, I'll look through and say like, all right, well, what did well and put on the podcast. Yeah. I'm like, well, I mean, this one only had like 3,000 views, you know, it only had 300 likes. Like,
that's pretty good.
I know, right? And I'm like looking at that, going, yeah. I don't know if this is good enough to make it to the next level.
Do you think that publishing it in the Mission is a big boost? I mean,
yes.
Is that part of the
relative to just me publishing it and not having it in a publication? I think it's totally a big boost. I mean, it has over 100, you know, has 150,000 or so readers. I'm also I'm also contributing to The Startup, which is another great big Medium publication. However, I'm not sure how their editorial process goes, and I guess I should probably just email and ask. I think it's Ali that runs it, and I just had stuff that I'll submit, and then it just never gets published. And it just and I like or come across it months later and be like, oh crap, they never published this, and so I'll just change it and say, all right, well, I'll put it in the Mission, and then 24 hours later, it's up.
Yeah,
so it's kind of
it sucks that you can only choose one. That's kind of a pain. It's like this or that.
Yeah, it would be nice if you could just be like, all right, whoever can do it first.
Yeah, or whoever's the biggest, like bid on it, or I don't know, something like
that. Yeah, and every once in a while there'll be smaller publications where I'll write something that's a little more different for a different niche, or not. Yeah. Not that I'm always trying to niche things, but sometimes, you know, I've explored a lot of different topics as well. Like my most popular post is like this really emotional one about. You know, somebody who died and it has a technological bent to it, but that's my most popular one by far. It has 107,000 views or something like that. It got picked up by Upworthy. It was just all over the place. And so that's been interesting too, is deviating from the things that I was writing about in the book. It's in some ways it's a deviation, but it is also still exploring this topic of the intersection between life and technology. So it does make me wonder if there's something there that I'm maybe just like a little too afraid to explore.
You feel like you're holding back on stuff that is not in the same vein as what you've been writing on, so you don't want to write about it?
Well, it's riskier, it's harder, right? Like if I write a productivity book, it will, you know, there's at least it can at least fall back on the fact that it's a productivity book, right? And mm-hmm. I have somewhat of an audience, like, you know, some people will buy the book. Mm-hmm. Now, if I write a book that's a little bit more exploratory, say it's essays that are exploring the relationship between life and technology or something like that, that's a lot riskier, right? It has the potential to reach a much wider audience, but it's a lot of a crapshoot, you know? I'm not like mm-hmm. a writer for the... I don't write like these great personal essays for the New Yorker or the New York Times or anything like that. It's risky. Now, it's interesting to me. I still explore those things now, especially after having some of it become successful. But some of the stuff I'm exploring. So
speaking of, I'm really curious to hear why last time we talked to each other, you were telling me that you were thinking about writing this book about managing technology. And now it sounds like you don't want to write that book anymore. What happened?
Yeah. Well, I think that a lot of the observations that you made, or I think you were basically saying, I think there's a lot of problems in making this a marketable book. And now that I've thought about it, now that I've gotten, writing on Medium and getting more of a sense of like what people want to read and what people react to and what people will listen to, I've gotten a lot of sense of that. You know, like if you tell people, oh, this is why we should be paying for Facebook. Like, not too many people want to read that article. Like, right. it's an inconvenient thing to read. And also, there was a conversation on the podcast that I had with Tucker Max about book marketing, and we really got deep into, like, why does somebody buy a book? And when somebody buys a book, what causes them to share it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, thinking about that sort of stuff, it's a tough angle. It's tough to think like, oh, here's this book about combating digital distraction. I think that maybe playing more of the, we can get to kind of what I'm thinking about now, I guess, but making it distraction focused, it's like people either want to have their beliefs confirmed, the sky is falling and here's all the reasons why, or such as the case with like the Shallows, it's not really big on like, oh, technology is great and it's actually making us smarter. I don't know if that's done super well. That's Clive Thompson's book, Smarter Than You Think.
Right.
And then if it comes to being like, oh, hey, you don't have the self-control to combat your bad technological habits, here's a book to help you with that. That starts to become a posture that people aren't comfortable with shelling out the money, which I think is what you were getting at last time we talked. Is that?
Yeah. Accurate? Yeah. Well, it's part of it. I mean, I've got so many questions, so many thoughts swirling around my head. But one thing I wanted to talk about first is like, what was the key takeaway from the Tucker Max conversation about why people buy books? And
I think for me, the key takeaway is, or the thing that I'm noticing more is like, when somebody buys a book, they want to say something about themselves to themselves. And when they recommend a book to a friend, they want to say something about themselves to that friend.
Right.
Like if you're like, hey, you got to read this book. It's called The Small Penis Owner's Handbook. Nobody's going to, like, the book's not going to sell. Right.
It's so funny because I own a copy of that one.
Oh, you do? Okay. It's a pretty good book.
I actually am the author. Oh, so embarrassing.
Yeah. So you know, right? You haven't told any of your friends about that book. Yeah. And, you know, as much as it helped you, you know, you did buy it. Like, it didn't spread because you didn't tell anybody about it, right? So I think that that has to be... You know, if somebody buys Getting Things Done, what are they saying to themselves? Like, what is almost hypnotic kind of message that they're giving to themselves is like, oh, getting things done. I'm a person who wants to get things done, who wants to be better, who, and it's not a book that's like, stop being scatterbrained, loser. It comes from a more positive, self-improvement place, which I think is why there's this whole category of self-improvement books, right? And so that's where I think that, you know, there's proven categories like productivity where you can write you write any book on productivity, I imagine like somebody will buy it just by virtue of it showing up in Amazon search results somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that insight around a book has to be an aspiration. I think that's a great insight. I think that's absolutely true. That I guess the struggle in a way is like you don't want to sell out, right? You don't want to not write something because it's not going to be commercially successful. On the other hand, obviously, you know, it's a gauge of demand as much as it is of market potential, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with it. I'm struggling with that as well, as like I got intros to a lot of agents, including from you. Thank you.
Yeah, and sure. You talked to Christy?
Yes, I'm starting to get like confused as to like who I did talk to. Yeah, I believe I did talk to Christy or somebody in her firm. And then,
okay, good.
Yeah, it was all like lukewarm response from most of them. Now the positive side is that they did a lot of them did respond, right? At least like so many people probably send tons of query letters and never get any sort of response, and I did get responses, and I even got, you know, one sent me some proposals from some of his clients and said, you know, if you just make this more focused, then we can talk again. And then there was another that like actually read the proposal and took the time to make really thoughtful suggestions that I am starting to develop on. But that was the end of the conversation, really. It was just like, okay, here's these suggestions. I kind of made a response to them, and then they're like, all right, well, that's cool. Well, you know, hope to see a new version of the proposal sometime. So that was, that. I haven't had an agent kind of say, oh, well, let me help you. Let's do this together. I don't know if that's something right. agents do.
I haven't seen them do it. It sounds like it would be it sounds like now the ball's in your court.
Yeah. Yeah. They want something they can sell right away, which is what, I had Ryan Holiday take a look at the proposal as well, which was extremely valuable feedback. I don't know. We probably already talked about that. But
no, I don't think we did.
Yeah. Well, I guess part of the thing that came out of that conversation was really about the angle, right? Is like taking my origin story. Why am I the person to write a book, on it, whatever topic that this book is about. Which, you know, I think Ryan might have had a little bit of a bias given his own story of like, this should be kind of an expose on the dirty tactics that companies use to distract you, because obviously what his book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, you know, really, really great. I think that's like the angle worked really well for him. I think that's like a part of my story is like, I worked in advertising. I worked as a designer. I didn't really like I felt really uncomfortable by the economics of the matter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then I ended up working with Dan Ariely to work on a product, which has features that ended up in Google Calendar. And, you know, now I live in Colombia in part because I find it a place where I can focus a lot better. So there's that little bit of an origin story, and it's certainly, yeah, if I'm going to try to like craft the book by template to be like what a well-selling book should be, is like, you know, it should be written by some university professor who went to an Ivy League school and et cetera, et cetera. And that hasn't been my path. So
right,
something
right.
a little bit ballsier or, I don't know, something, I feel like something a little sloppy in a way.
Interesting. I want to go back to something you said earlier around the writing so much on Medium helped reveal what people really want to read about. Mm-hmm. What is it? What did you learn? And how did you learn it, actually? Was it just by the sheer fact that you wrote something every single day? Is that how you learned it, or was there something else?
Well, this is something I'm always thinking about, and this is something that I think in a lot of ways it holds my writing back, but when things finally converge, then it makes my writing that much better, is that I'm always really trying to find, like, the entry point into the mind of the reader, and realizing that whatever it is that you want to say, usually you're not going to get them to take it by just saying it, right? You have to have, like, the Trojan horse, right? So if I'm to think about, like, my most popular article is about, or actually an article I wrote recently, Yes, You Can Leave the North America Bubble. It is about life and technology, and it is about the way that technology shapes our lives, but the entry point into it is something that, like, you can see somebody sharing it on Facebook. Like, if I had just written, I moved to the third world for a better life, then it starts to look like, well, here's this privileged person that went to go live somewhere that's cheaper. And, you know, meanwhile, many people are, it becomes a little bit unclear. If you try to imagine, okay, so this is one of my tricks, I think, is I try to imagine somebody sharing it on Facebook. And what is the subtext of their sharing? And Tucker and I talked about this, too, that, you know, if you share the Yes, You Can Leave the North America Bubble, you were saying, like, a lot of people say, oh, I can relate to the things that this author observed about his experience living in another country. I am cultured. I am not a closed-minded North American that doesn't bother to learn any new languages, that never leaves the country, et cetera, et cetera. It sounds like really demeaning when I say it that way, but it's true. Like, you have to be able to, if somebody's going to share something, they need to be able to say something about themselves with that. And I've had other things I've written where, like, I wrote a book or I wrote a blog post about, you know, working for a Silicon Valley startup and getting paid a lot and looking at my paycheck and kind of being like, well, where the fuck did this money come from? This doesn't make any sense. I don't feel like I earned this. And that was like, it wasn't a hit, but it was like a dark, what's the word? Dark social. I think it was like maybe a dark social hit, where it's like people didn't want to share it on their Facebook or their Twitter because they're afraid their boss might see and realize that they don't like their jobs, which was, you know, observations some people had told me. But at the same time, I was getting tons of, like, personal messages saying, wow, thanks for sharing this story. I can totally relate to this. I know how you feel, etc. And so there's different dimensions. And I think that it depends. And I don't think that just because somebody will click on an article or share it on Facebook, that means that they'll buy a book on that topic. Or at least not in the way that it's packaged.
So yeah, would it be sure? Would someone want to share this on Facebook?
Yeah, and what would they say? You know, would you share it on Facebook? If you were sharing it on Facebook and you hadn't written it, what would you say? And that's it's amazing too. If you just scroll through your Facebook feed. And you imagine the subtext of what people are saying as they're sharing everything. It's really a paradigm shift for me.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Huh, I'm going to write that down right now.
We're going to take a quick break. Remember when you used to enlist your friends to help you move? You'd round up a bunch of them and waste an entire Saturday giving them hernias, and all for a couple slices of pizza. I remember the first time that I hired movers. I wondered to myself, why had it taken me so long to realize what a good deal this was? A few hundred dollars to save my friendships and not lose my deposit by driving the corner of my couch through the drywall? Yeah, that was worth it. Sometimes you just grow out of the scarcity mindset. Like the time that I grew out of my $5 a month hosting plan. I think it happened at 3 a.m. on a Saturday night while I was busy picking malware links out of my templates. I moved to WP Engine, and I never looked back. WP Engine is not your $5 a month hosting plan where your site is left vulnerable to hackers and you have to worry about keeping it up to date yourself. Mindset shift. WP Engine costs a fraction of what your cable bill costs. If you want your site to succeed, you've got to invest in a good host. WP Engine can increase your conversions and protect your WordPress site from hackers. Learn more at wpengine.com/lyw.
Cool. All right. So, what's the next book, or what did you morph into that you're going to do instead of the book you killed?
Well, I mean, I didn't necessarily kill the book. So, like, some of the feedback I got was,
"You killed it."
Fine, I killed it. No, but one of the feedback that I got was just, all right, so the book that I proposed that I had was like this terribly overdone metaphor that I created of like how doing mentally heavy work is like riding a bicycle, and that there's different parts of the bike ride that you need to be sensitive to, and that, you know, you need to get your own productivity cycles in tune with the tools that you're using and in tune with the rhythm of the world around you. Now, even as I say that, I'm like, okay, yeah, it makes sense, but it's not crisp. It doesn't come off as like a crisp book idea where when you imagine, here's another trick I do. If someone's going to imagine somebody's recommending your book to a friend at a party, and what are they saying? Mm-hmm. Or when they're telling your story, they're saying, oh, there's this guy who, yada yada yada, and like that, they have to be able to say that in like a clean sentence for your idea to spread.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. And actually, I saw that. That was reinforced by a talk I saw at Podcast Movement. There were these gals who do this podcast called Criminal, and they tell, it's a great podcast, I've listened to it since, and they tell stories, and that was what their talk was about, was stories and about how when they craft a story, they think about that way. It's like, oh, there's this guy, there's this gal who X, what was it that they did? Because that's what makes us, you know, like, stories are so powerful. And so your own story, right, as an author needs to be a part of the book a lot of the times.
Right, right. Yeah, if it's not easily understood, it's not easily shared. So it has to, story is that vehicle to get something into someone's brain, yeah, enough to be able to. Yeah, another trick is pictures. I think that's an underutilized hack.
Oh, okay.
Right, that, like, I think that really worked for me with Hooked, is that people could draw the hook, right?
Oh,
like,
yes,
you know, they do a 2x2, and then, you know, I have this acronym of ATARI that stands for a hook stands has four parts: a trigger, an action, a reward, investment, ATARI. And like that actually made it kind of easy to teach others. And so that's definitely something I'm going to do on my next book if I figure out.
Well, the image of a hook in general, too. I think there's like, I've read a little bit about NLP, but I don't totally grok it. But I understand that there's these ideas of images or the ways that different people's minds works, and so like having this image of a hook, like literally a hook, like a fish hook, like.
Yeah, it's funny because I when I first started writing about it, it was the same four steps, but I called it something awful. I'm almost embarrassed to tell you. I called it the desire engine.
This is what I've learned,
which
too,
of course,
is like simple language, like the most simple language you can think of.
Like nobody remembers what the hell the desire engine is, but when you called it the hook, you know, then like, I don't know, maybe it's because the Blues Traveler song or something, like people remember the hook. Like, what's your hook? Okay, that's like, let me tell you about this book, Hooked. Like, it was very easily transferable, I think. I mean, who knows, right? This is all anecdotal.
No, it's true. It's like Trump knows best, you know, like.
Crooked Hillary, he says it 1,000 times and it becomes reality for people, even though it's not. But that, you know, well, if you say it enough times, people remember it.
this is why I cringe when I see somebody with a sign or a t-shirt that says, like, love trumps hate. I don't know if you've seen that. That's, like, one of Hillary's sort of slogans. And it's like, your opponent's name is in this slogan. Like, don't right. do that. Don't.
Yes, yes. Like, you can never underestimate the power of the mirror exposure effect.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I mean, that's I can't cite the studies necessarily, but I've certainly heard over and over again. It's just like the more time somebody's exposed to something, the more favorably they start to see it.
Right. I mean, I think that's Trump in a nutshell right there. You know, he's I think it was a New Yorker article or somewhere that I read that Trump is what poor people think of a rich person should be, right? It's like a poor person's conception of a rich person, because no rich, I know billionaires, and nobody acts like Trump who has $1 billion. It's only people who, you know, don't know right. what real rich people are like think that Trump yeah. is actually what a rich person is. But you know, that's through the mere exposure effect, that's how you get someone to like a person who acts like that.
Yeah, and so I've started to get really interested in this sort of how ideas stick and how they become appealing thing, and it's interesting as I'm writing for Medium to think about, all right, wait, starting to get a sense of would somebody highlight this or not. But actually, you asked about the book, so
yeah. Sorry, got off track.
No, that's fine. So what we ended up. What they ended up sort of suggesting was that I had these categorizations just from my sample chapter about how doing creative work or doing mentally heavy work isn't just to use Cal Newport's thing. It's not just deep work, shallow work. Like there are different contours within there. So there is the generation of a rough draft, but at the same time there is, doing research, so you don't, as you're writing a rough draft, if you come across a fact that you don't know, you don't need to like go look it up. You need to stay on that level. You need to put it in brackets and then take it off as a separate thing. And there can be certain times of day and times of the week that are better for you to do that sort of stuff than others. So it's a little bit more like taking some of these categorizations and writing a chapter on each one and weaving it. And this part pleases me because it ties into things that I've fantasized about for such a book, and weaving it in sort of with my own story of kind of the agony of being a first-time author, having not written a book and banging my head against the wall 12 hours a day to only get 15 minutes of flow, and then retooling everything to finally get into that. But the tricky part is like the origin story thing. Like that, in their opinion, and I kind of agree, just saying like, oh yeah, I wrote a book and it was hard, isn't necessarily a strong origin story to give me authority as an author. Whereas the fact that I have worked as a designer and I understand to a decent extent how this works and how the economics of technology companies work to incentivize, to distract, that I have some sort of perspective there to share that about how I struggled myself with those things and how I managed to fight back on those things and then eventually work on the new Google Calendar features to take some of these principles and put them into an app, ironically enough. So the story part is compelling to me because I had done a lot of some rereading of some books that I had read. And one of them in particular, it's embarrassing because it's a very childish and juvenile book, but The Game by Neil Strauss. There's the way, I don't know if you've ever read the book before, but it is sort of how to interwoven with story. And I find that really compelling. And oddly enough, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, that might just be because of style, because it sort of jumps around and goes off on these philosophical rants and such. Now, such a book with, you know, stories such as that interwoven with how different challenges were met, it's a hard book to categorize, and it's which is what makes it risky, which could possibly make it interesting.
Yeah. Oh, I haven't read it. Maybe I should. It sounds like it's a good, so that's the kind of style you want to go for.
Yeah, I guess I struggle with, the traditional business book, style, where it's very organized and it's very, you could have just condensed this down to a bunch of bullet points and the reader could have gotten just as much out of it, which, you're not to totally denigrate that. Like, that's really useful. But I guess, and I haven't totally honed in on my premise, but it might be a part of it, really, is that work is increasingly going to be less linear and more iterative, mm-hmm. and more thrashing around and trying to make that creative epiphany happen.
Mm-hmm.
More and more as things become automated, as fewer people are making widgets for a living, as performance in your job becomes more dependent on your ability to look at a problem that you've never had before and that nobody's ever had before, and to be able to come up with something original.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I'm struggling with the similar. We're both revolving around similar universes here, I guess you could say. You know, I kind of had a similar journey to you, whereas I thought for a long time I was going to write Unhooked, and I wrote a ton of articles about, you know, how to put technology in its place and how to manage distraction, and I was kind of like, okay, maybe I started the Frankenstein monster, not started, but I promoted, I helped incubate a lot of these technologies with the work I was doing with Hooked, and like now I'm captured by these technologies and I can't stop using them. But so I wanted to work on Unhooked, and I did a talk on it, like a TED style talk on it, and wrote a bunch of articles, and I have enough for a book already. But I just not I think the discovery that I made was that I would get distracted by anything, you know. Like, I took all these steps and I put all these things in my way so that I wouldn't use these technologies. And I used every like app blocking app, and I deleted all the apps from my phone, and I like just tried to focus and like get my work done and write. But, you know, then I would like, oh, there's a book on the shelf I've been meaning to look at. And, oh, you know, my closets need organizing. I mean, it was so stupid, so ridiculous. But like, I basically would turn out like I just wasn't into the thing that I was supposed to be working on. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I should have done a better job of listening to what I want to do versus what I think I have to do. And it was turned out like it's not really the technology's fault, is what I concluded. It's just good old procrastination.
Yeah, this reminds me of a piece of feedback that I got when Ryan Holiday reviewed my proposal. It was basically I had this the metaphor was like the bicycle and the bumper car that Steve Jobs had this vision of a computer as a bicycle for the mind, and that it would increase our efficiency, but that we have these bumper cars on our just all over in our world. And he's like, well, bumper cars are fun. Like, people love bumper cars. Like, people love to binge on Netflix. Like, you can't write a book telling people not to binge on Netflix and not to spend time on Facebook, et cetera, and then expect that to be the crux of it and for people to be receptive.
And I agree. I mean, it's kind of, you know, there's so much silliness around technology and pointing the finger at technology. I know we had a big debate last time we talked, but
yeah,
I mean, come on, give me, like, it's not, you know, we're not freebasing Facebook. We're not, you know, we're not injecting Instagram. Like, mm-hmm. I think there are people. I wrote this article in The Atlantic that nobody read, but I thought was pretty good, which was about like real addicts, people who really cannot stop. And people get addicted to all sorts of stuff. And I think, like, that's the kind of person we should be worried about. But for everybody else, it's not that – like, it's a self-control issue. And if it wasn't Facebook, it would be television. If it wasn't television, it would be books. And if it wasn't books, it would be who knows what. Like, there's just always distractions. And so it's – you know, because we think these things are good and fun and interesting, we blame them when we don't, you know, do something more productive. But that's what they're for. They're entertainment. And so it's – I think we point the finger more than we should. I mean, these products are good.
It's a waking up. It's a mindfulness problem. It's not so much a it's just a universal, timeless problem with presence.
Right. I mean, I wrote about this in a few articles around this concept of akrasia that Aristotle and Socrates were debating around why we tend to do things against our better interests. So, like, okay, humans have been struggling with this since forever, right? Like, it's nothing new that we, whatever it is that we want to do, there's always something there next to us that makes, that's more appealing when the thing you want to do is different from the thing you need to do.
Well, how about this? Do you ever think about this? You know, that you and I in our respective, was that your first book?
Hooked?
Yeah.
Yeah, first and only.
You and I in our respective first and only books, you know, we kind of got lucky, and we took advantage of the opportunity. We seized the opportunity, and we got the thing that we had to say out there, and we were fortunate to have a lot of people interested in that. And you know, maybe that's it. Maybe we don't, you know, maybe we're not supposed to write another book. Like, has that become our job now, that just because we've each written books that people cared about, that somehow now we have to put effort into mining the nooks and crannies of our psyche and our lives to find something that is presentable? Is this the type of thing that just causes a sophomore slump?
That sounds horrible. That's super depressing. I mean, look, it could be. I've thought about that a lot, and then I drink. So I hope not, because I really enjoy the process of writing. And I really enjoy when what I have a time thinking about is something that other people wanted the answers to as well. I mean, I like, it's professionally the most fulfilling thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
But it's really fucking hard. It's not easy, but it's like a beautiful sort of torture that I'm sure you've experienced, right? Like, it's really good when you're in that flow state and answering a question that you really care about. So I hope not. I mean, I'm still curious about stuff. I still want the answer to stuff. And I guess that's the paradox we were talking about earlier, or not the paradox, the conflict, I think, that I try and keep out of my mind is, like, you know, it's more important that I conquer something interesting that I want to wake up and answer every day than something commercial. And so, like, let's say I go and I spent a year, I literally spent a year writing about ethics and how to put technology in its place. It's not going to be a book. But I think I really have a good answer for it now. Like, when somebody comes to me and says, I read Hooked and how dare you teach people how to make addictive products, I have a really good answer now that I feel really good about and that I can go to sleep every night, you know, knowing I'm not negligent, you know. So even if it's not a book.
But so, I mean, so then maybe as – to argue against that own possibility is that, you know, because you and I have experienced saying something that a fair amount of people wanted to hear about and exploring that we've gained a skill that that is unique and that lowers our cost of investment in stumbling across something like that again. Is that possible?
Wait, so you're saying that we have an asset now because we have an audience?
Well, no, in our own minds. I mean, to me, like, writing, I don't know if this is the case for you. You spent a year writing about ethics and stuff. Now, like, that, and that's all to come up with this, like, crisp one or two sentences that you can say to a person when you find yourself in that situation, that the thinking, the exploring of myriad things to develop a cohesive understanding of the way that you think that the world fits together and the mechanics of that world, that thinking is like the valuable thing. It's not the fact that we sit down and that one of us can type faster than anybody else.
Is
that a skill that we've developed, and is that why we should write another? Is that part of why maybe writing another book is something that either of us should do?
I think I want to write another book because this is my most enjoyable form of finding meaning in life. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's no, you know, I'm a pretty staunch atheist, and I don't think that there's any higher purpose to being here. That the meaning of life is to find meaning in life, and this is the best way I figured out how to find meaning in life. Like how to, like, it feels really great to produce something that other people find helpful, and that I want answered, and that's it. Honestly, if like I could do something else that brought me as much satisfaction and like gave me purpose and meaning, then maybe I would do that. But that's the only reason. I don't know why. I think that we just have we're in a very fortunate position that like, we can do this kind of stuff, right? Like, you know, artists need sponsors, and our sponsors are the public that buys our stuff,
right?
And pays us to think of these ideas. And so, like, that's kind of a luxury that, I don't find it as like a responsibility per se, but more of like, well, what the hell else am I going to do with my time?
We're here, we have to do something. Yeah. So
like, what am I going to, like, yeah, this occupy, and that's kind of how I look at, by the way, it just kind of hand in glove with the, using technology and you know, getting becoming, you know, consumed with technology. You know, part of what I see when people get consumed in technology, when I study people who like use some of these tech, you know, games and different apps too much, is that for them it is meaning, you know, like it is purpose just as much. You know, a lot of the folks that are obsessed with Pokemon Go or World of Warcraft are folks that work really shitty jobs during the daytime. And then this is like where their friends are and what provides them meaning and like what makes life worth living for them. And so who am I to say like, no, that's not, you know, that's not good. You should be writing a book like me. Whereas my silly obsession is just as to them looks just as silly as, you know, their obsession.
Right.
So I don't know.
Have you ever read Doing Good Better?
No.
I mean, I don't know if you need to read it, but it's a great book by William McCaskill, who I've tried many times to try to get him on the podcast, but he's a pretty big deal. It is basically a framework for deciding what's the most impact that you can have on the world. And he runs an organization called 80,000 Hours, which helps people find the highest impact career that they can have. And as a part of that framework, you know, if a person is comfortable with having a high percentage chance of failure, something like being an author or being an entrepreneur is, as they rate, one of the, you know, highest impact professions that you can have, just by the fact that, like, okay, let's say there's a 1% chance that you have a giant impact on the world. Well, that becomes then, from a utilitarian standpoint, like, okay, that's the best that you can do if you're comfortable with the fact that you might fail. So that's something that, as I've evaluated, the best use of my existence has comforted me in thinking that I'm doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just because we've all read books that just blew our brains apart.
Right.
You never saw the world the same way again.
Right. And that's to me, like, I call those mind orgasms.
Yeah.
And like, that's it, I would love to figure out how to give people that.
Yeah.
Because I value it. Like, I really, I just love those, and they don't come around very often. And sometimes you can get them, doesn't have to be a book. Sometimes it can be an amazing movie or a really well-written essay. But yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And like, that's what I aspire to. That's what I would love to do for folks.
It can be a tiny article, you know? It can be a 500-word Medium article that does it sometimes. And so, yeah, that's exactly, I think, the thing that drives me, too, is being able to get that note that, like, whoa, this thing blew my mind. I haven't seen such and such thing the same way since I read this thing that you wrote.
Yeah. I mean, that's crazy shareable, too, right? Like, when you can do that for folks, that feels so good for people.
Yeah.
That it takes care of itself. I mean, it doesn't, you know, for all the headline optimization and Facebook optimization, you know, all those techniques, at the end of the day, if you give people that rare feeling, it spreads. It's really hard to do.
Yeah.
Because you have to surprise people. Fundamentally, you have to tell them something they haven't already heard 1,000 times. So, you know, if I hear about the fucking marshmallow study at Stanford one more time, you know, I'm going to scream like, I've heard about it.
Yeah.
We all heard about it.
Yeah.
So it has to be something surprising and helpful, which is not easy to do.
Yeah. There's going to be a podcast coming out tomorrow with Max Temkin from Cards Against Humanity. And that's an amazing conversation. Have you ever played Cards Against Humanity? You're familiar with that game?
No, I've heard of it. I haven't played it.
Okay, well, it was just such an explosive thing. And they've done these amazing Black Friday sales. Like, one of them was, the first one was, oh, well, Cards Against Humanity is $5 more today. And then the next year, they sold boxes of holiday bullshit. Like, they just sold actual bullshit. And then this last year, they had the Cards Against Humanity, the holiday Give Cards Against Humanity $5 event sale. And we are the only company that has the integrity to give you nothing, and it costs you only $5. And they made $70,000. They shut down their store for that day, and they made $70,000. People giving them $5 and checking a box saying, I realize I'm not getting anything when I'm just giving you $5. Right? And it's just like so, as he explains it, it's like third level recursive jujitsu marketing, because they don't have a Black Friday marketing budget. But at the same time, they don't have a budget for advertising to compete against Mattel or whatever. And at the same time, they you know, want to sell their game, and they also hate Black Friday, so they've made this brilliant thing that their customers are a part of, right? Like the customers gave them $5 to be a part of the joke,
right? To be a part of the joke
of just like, oh, that's hilarious. They want us to give them $5 for nothing. Okay, like one person gave them $5 20 different times because it was like. I imagine just so funny to this person that they just kept
right
giving him $5.
Wow, that's phenomenal.
Yeah. So, that's just to say that's just one of the many ways of tickling the brain. That I mean, this is what I try to study day in, day out. It's the thing that I think like holds me back from short-term success. That I just trust that will eventually pay off, but in the meantime, I just really enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, one step at a time. You know, I mean, look how far I've come since the last time we checked in. You know, you've learned a ton. You're growing your audience. I'm on the same path. So I don't know what the final destination is. It's great work, I guess, but that's not a goal. It's a process.
Yeah. This could actually be a podcast conversation. This might.
Yeah, go for it. Sure, go for it. I don't think I said anything I don't want shared. So why not?
Yeah, sure. Well, even the small penis odors guide, is that
I especially want that published. Are you kidding me? The world should know.
They must know the truth. Oh man. Anything else? What else is up?
That's about it. I actually have to run here in a minute, but it was really good talking to you, as always. And anytime you want to catch up, it's just great to kind of hear your journey because we're on such similar paths here. And,
yeah.
If I can be helpful with anything, or if you want to collaborate with anything, or if you think of any crazy ideas you want to run by each other, I'm all ears. That would be great.
Yeah, I think that would be great. And if this is published and anybody's listening, I think it's always the outsiders that are best at seeing these opportunities. So. I know it's like I've got to get hit over the head by an opportunity before I realize it's there.
Yeah, likewise. Awesome. Yeah, I would love to hear what your listeners think.
Yeah. Cool. All right, well, thanks for the chat.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, and let's keep in touch.
All right. Have a great day.
All right, you too. Bye-bye. All right.
Your designer has been lying to you. Design doesn't have to be a mystery. You can do it. Get $100 off any pay upfront package of my flagship visual design course, D4H Video. Just go to cadavy.net/video and use the code LOVEIT on any pay upfront package. Hopefully that conversation gave you some ideas about how to analyze your own book ideas and how you can test some of those ideas specifically on medium.com. For more in-depth analysis of book marketing psychology, check out episode 29 with Tucker Max, who is a 3-time New York Times bestselling author and who helps numerous other authors become successful through his company, Book in a Box. And if you appreciate all the work that goes into making this show, there are a few ways you can help support it. One is to subscribe, whether it's on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, just hit the subscribe button. Another is to rate the show on iTunes, just go to cadavy.net/iTunes, click on Write a Review, and click on the star rating. You don't even have to actually write a review. It just takes a couple seconds just to click. The final way is to use my affiliate link when shopping on Amazon. Just go to cadavy.net/Amazon anytime you shop on Amazon. And that will magically donate a portion of your purchase toward making Love Your Work. And it doesn't cost you anything. And before I go, I've got to ask, do you like books? If you do, sign up for my book recommendations. About 90% will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to cadavy.net/reading and get the first set of recommendations right away. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is CNU, performed by The Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.